Welcome to the seventh installment of Piper Sandler's 30-Minute Market Insight Series. In today's environment, every day presents new challenges and opportunities. The goal of this conference call series is to take a holistic approach to understanding the marketplace by featuring a different sector and subject matter expert to share timely insights that influence all industries. My name is Pierce Hammond, and I am a Managing Director and Senior Research Analyst covering midstream and infrastructure at Simmons Energy, a division of Piper Sandler, and I'll be your co-presenter today, along with Ryan Todd, Managing Director and Senior Research Analyst, covering the major integrated oils and refining. Today we will be discussing what's next for energy as the economy reopens. The call is designed to be no longer than 30 minutes, and therefore we will not have time for audience questions. If you have any questions following the call, please reach out to your Piper Simmons representative. As a reminder, this call cannot be referenced in any articles, and this conversation should be considered off the record. And with that, let's go ahead and get started. As I previously stated, for the next 30 minutes, we want to discuss what's ahead for energy as the economy opens back up, and what is likely to be a very fitful, back-and-forth affair of increasing economic activity, but limited and governed by the virus. And one of the key questions energy investors and energy companies are curious about is what the forward path for oil demand looks like. Ryan Todd and his team have done extensive research on oil demand. So, Ryan, what is the outlook for oil demand, and how long will it take to get back to pre-COVID-19 demand levels?
Thanks, Pierce. Our outlook for demand, I think it's fair to say, it's probably more cautious than those put forward by a number of other forecasting agencies, where we expect global demand to recover to roughly 95 million barrels a day by the fourth quarter of this year, which is still significantly a significant improvement from being down almost 30 million barrels a day at the trough. So roughly 95 million barrels a day by the fourth quarter of this year. We expect it to average about 96.5 million barrels a day in 2021, 98.7 in 2022. We don't see global demand returning to 2019 levels of roughly 100 million barrels a day until 2023. I think, you know, the way that we approach demand, I think, is that for most of the world, our forecast is driven by a global GDP forecast, which is roughly in line with that of the IMF. And is a little over 3% down in 2020, and then 5.8% increase in 2021. And then on the side of that, that goes into our forecast of total non-U.S. global oil demand. And then we make some adjustments for global jet fuel demand, where we assume a long-term structural reduction of about 15% to global air travel. And modest adjustments to European and Asian gasoline demand from a small impact on the margin from working from home dynamics. I think what differentiates our demand forecast is our approach to U.S. product demand. We're based on a lot of historical analyses of a lot of data from 40 years of past cycles. We've built out a model that dynamically adjusts for the impacts to elevated levels of unemployment, which are significant, as well as for shifts in behavior from working from home and even the potential shift from mass transit to cars for commuting. In terms of inputs, we assume that roughly 10% of employees with the potential to work from home decide to work from home longer term, while roughly 5% of mass transit commuters switch to cars over the longer term. In the end, although the near-term recovery in vehicle miles traveled has been quite aggressive, we expect that the elevated levels of unemployment and working from home dynamics will put somewhat of a ceiling on how far gasoline can recover over the next 18 months. And I think this is one of the drivers of why we're lower than a number of our peers, is I think people, you know, we believe that people are underestimating the impacts of some of these trends, in particular the higher than normal levels of unemployment and some of the other marginal impacts like working from home and the ceiling that's going to put on U.S. gasoline demand, which was already in a flat to declining place even before COVID. So, I mean, we recognize there's a huge amount of uncertainty with demand forecasts right now, both in terms of overall economic recovery, employment trends, how much structural and lingering impact there is from some of these short-term trends. On the margin, however, we expect that the pandemic will probably accelerate some of the longer-term trends regarding carbon transition, efficiency, mobility, et cetera.
Ryan, thank you for that. It's very helpful. What would be your major kind of puts and takes around this demand forecast?
I think the biggest one by far is probably unemployment. And I think if you look back at, I think a lot of times people have tried to correlate demand with GDP. That demand, certainly, particularly in things like gasoline, really falls apart during times of cyclical downturns. And I think the strongest correlation that we found going back to all the data is when you make the adjustments for population growth, is generally that unemployment historically has had a significant impact on U.S. gasoline demand. And if you look at the numbers for us, like in our base case, if you look at our unemployment estimates, and these are based on, we assume a more optimistic recovery than what the most recent CBO forecast was, and it's probably in line with, I think, what we would kind of say kind of consensus blue chip forecasters are. But in terms of unemployment rates, our expectation is that by fourth quarter of 2020, we're down, from a trough that's, 16% plus, you're down to kind of 11.5% unemployment rate. At the end of 2021, you're down to about 8.5% unemployment rate, and then you're recovering kind of 1-1.5% a year from there. What that does is that by 2021, under that forecast, you're about 7% lower on vehicle miles traveled, just driven by unemployment, from where you would be, kind of in a normalized pre-COVID situation. And so I think by far, that's the biggest lever that we have to pull. Working from home has the potential to have, almost as sizable of an impact as unemployment. Again, our long-term assumption is that 10% of those employees that have the potential, whose jobs have the potential to be worked from home, will actually make the decision to work from home longer term. If that goes materially higher, then that's a pretty significant lever you can pull as well.
Excellent, Ryan. Thanks for that perspective. And then for those listeners on this podcast that are curious, the Simmons Energy Research Team published an extensive energy macro note on June the 10th, so just last week, and much of that material we are discussing today. So if you're interested in reading that report, please reach out to your Simmons Energy representative. Now I'd like to summarize our U.S. oil supply expectations that were put together by Cashy Harrison and our E&P team. Overall, we do not expect U.S. oil production to return to the pre-COVID peak of 13 million barrels a day during our forecast period, which is through the end of 2022. Our expectation is that U.S. total oil production will decline from 12.7 million barrels a day in Q1 20 to 10.8 million barrels a day in Q4 20, and then essentially stay flat at this production level until the second half of 22, when production starts increasing again. In Q4 22, U.S. oil production is at nearly 11.1 million barrels a day based on our forecast. Now, if we looked at rather than just total U.S., which would take into account Alaska and the Gulf of Mexico, but if we just looked at lower 48 onshore, we have oil production declining from 10.3 million barrels a day for the average in Q1 of 20 to 8.3 million barrels a day in Q4 of 20. So that's a 2 million barrel a day drop from the first quarter to the fourth quarter. And by Q4 22, it's at nearly 8.5 million barrels a day, so it's slightly higher than where it'll exit this year. Now, which basins will outperform? Based on our forecast, no surprise, the Permian. We estimate Permian production will be at 4.57 million barrels a day at the end of last year, declines to 3.8 million barrels a day in Q3 20, and then climbs back essentially pretty close to where it was pre-COVID by the end of 22. In Q1 of 20, the Permian was 44% of our lower 48 onshore oil production forecast, and by Q4 22, it's 52%. So you can see it gained share. If you contrast that with the Eagle Ford over the same time period, it loses share. It goes from 13% of total Lower 48 production to 11%. And the Bakken moves down slightly from 15% to 14%. So clearly and unsurprisingly, the Permian's the winner. Now, why is it the U.S. oil production is slow to rebound? You know, a few reasons. Number one, the demand figures that Ryan discussed earlier, which certainly, you know, does not point to getting back to those pre-COVID levels of demand for some time. And then number two, Saudi and Russia not wanting the U.S. to regain all of its lost share. And number three, when we look at forward demand growth, it's expected to be supplied predominantly through the monetization of shut-in production and spare production capacity, also enveloped by a backdrop of exceedingly high inventory levels. So what about U.S. rig count? We expect the rig count to bottom on a quarterly average basis in Q3 20 at 237 rigs. That's down from nearly 800 rigs on average in the first quarter of this year. We then have it steadily increasing to reach 370 rigs on average in Q4 of 21 and then 605 rigs in Q4 of 22. And what about completions? While we do not expect drilling activity to meaningfully recover until 2021, we anticipate a quicker recovery in completions activity due to the significant backlog of drilled but not completed horizontal wells across the major basins, which require about $35 WTI to break even at the well level. And so, you know, that's our view on U.S. oil supply. It's now I'd like to turn it back to Ryan to discuss international non-OPEC supply and specifically what is our outlook for international non-OPEC supply over our forecast period. Ryan?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of non-OPEC supply, there are a few large questions that I think everybody wrestles with and kind of drive the forecast from here. The first is production curtailments. And you know, you were just talking about U.S. production curtailments. There have been significant production curtailments on the ex-U.S. non-OPEC side as well. Over the near term, second quarter 20, 3Q 20, we expect curtailments to account for roughly 7 to 8% of full year 19 international non-OPEC supply, which averages out to around 3.5 million barrels a day of idle near-term productive capacity outside of the U.S. and OPEC. We think that that's, you know, 70% of that is driven by Russia and Canada in terms of the curtailed volumes from April through September. There may be some risk to our outlook of the 1.2 million barrels a day of Canadian curtailments that we expect for the third quarter, as both pricing and differentials have recovered from the lows that we saw in kind of late March and into April. And there have been some adjustments to turnaround schedules at a number of the oil sands facilities up there. But overall, we see about, you know, on an annual average basis, we see 2.4 million barrels a day of curtailment impact in 2020, 1.25 million barrels a day in 2021, and then falling to 250,000 barrels a day of lingering curtailments in 2022. But clearly a huge amount of uncertainty in terms of the timing of how those volumes make their way back into the market. The second thing I think is on, you know, underlying decline rate and or work delays. And this one is a bit of a catch-all. I mean, I think there's a couple things that drive it. Whenever we have one of these downturns and there's a collapse in price, there's always a big debate around underlying decline rates and an expectation or a hope that decline rates will accelerate materially driven by lack of investment and reductions in capital. We do, with this one, you also have kind of a unique driver of things, which is that because of the effects of the pandemic, it's also limiting the ability at certain large projects around the world for work to be ongoing at those projects, whether it's from infill drilling and, you know, and development or workovers. As you think about it, a lot of these are very large facilities with a lot of people, a lot of personnel, and very close quarters. There have been a number of large projects, a number of, you know, around the world where companies have already said they've had to reduce the employee and the personnel on site, which could moderate the amount of volumes that you see coming out of those projects in the nearer term. So kind of that catch-all, you know, we think that our non-OPEC decline rate, ex-Russia, Canada, increases to 5.5% a year in the very near term, which is about 0.5% higher than what we expected before. This kind of takes the impact of this is that if we were to ignore the effects of curtailments, we would have non-OPEC production declining by roughly 300,000 barrels a day a year through 2022 versus prior expectations of probably 100,000 barrels a day a year of annual growth. So, by 2022, you're over 1 million barrels a day of impact in terms of that non-OPEC supply. And then the third thing is the long-term project delays. This is really a 2024 to 2026 plus type of impact. This is things like the announced delays that you've seen the major deepwater projects like in Guyana, where you've seen a 6 to 12 month delay in phases three plus there. And a similar thing happening with a lot of pre-FID projects. Again, that's probably more, that's more of a 4 year plus impact in terms of plan, but there's a pretty material impact both in the very near term as well as kind of the 2 to 3 year over our forecast period impact in terms of non-OPEC supply.
And then, Ryan, what would you say are the major puts and takes around that whole international non-OPEC supply that you just walked through?
Russia, I think you might touch on Russia a little bit. Whether you count Russia in the non-OPEC or in the OPEC plus, Russia and their decision to whether how long they're going to curtail or not is obviously a big thing. Outside of that, I think, Canada is really one of the big, wild cards that we see here. A lot of volumes offline right now in Canada. It's very pricing dependent in a lot of ways. So, the pace at which those volumes do or do not come online is going to have a material impact on the forecast.
Great. Well, thank you, Ryan. And so to summarize, we've already discussed global demand. We've talked about U.S. oil supply. We've talked about international non-OPEC supply. So the final piece of the puzzle here is to discuss OPEC and specifically kind of their behavior and potential market share strategy. So the question from this point is the durability of the Saudi-Russian rational guardianship. So rational guardianship meaning that they are helping manage the market so that the market is not oversupplied and keeping prices at a higher level than they would be otherwise. Now, the longer that Saudi and Russia suppress production, the more likely oil prices continue to normalize higher, and a continued swift improvement in oil prices will lead to a shallower reduction and a quicker recovery in lower 48 oil production. All else equal, this should lead to a lower call on OPEC production required to balance the market. Now, with regard to the call on OPEC production required to achieve inventory neutrality, although we are modeling sustained increases throughout our forecast period, our estimated call on OPEC as we exit 2022 is in line with production levels which prevailed immediately before the pandemic. All in, we are modeling an increase in the call on OPEC production over the next 6 to 7 quarters, beginning in Q3 of 20, of approximately 5 to 6 million barrels a day, rising from 24.5 million barrels a day in Q3 20 to 31 million barrels a day in Q1 22, before subsequently moderating over the balance of 22 due to reviving lower 48 oil production growth. We believe almost the entirety of the increase in the call on OPEC production can be fulfilled through the revival of shut-in production. And final point is just keep in mind, though, that Saudi could push for market share. They tried it before and so could certainly do it again. So we've walked through, the key components of our oil outlook. And now I'd like to turn it to Ryan to say, as an investor, what energy subsectors should benefit the most from the forecast that we have outlined? And I know you've made a good call on the refining sector. Ryan?
Yeah, thanks. I think at a high level, one of the things that we wrestle with is that nobody in energy really, it's a demand-driven business, and with an underwhelming demand forecast to some reason, it's a bit of a headwind for everybody. But when we think about relative benefits, the refining sector is one sector that we do think is we expect to be generally more resilient through this. And this goes to a bunch of, you know, whether it's fundamental operating conditions, which is the relatively low capital intensity of the business, their ability to generate free cash flow, even with relatively moderate margins. But also because given how we view the forecast going forward, you know, we think that product balances are a little easier to manage than crude balances are. And some of that goes to the fact that the proactivity that we've seen from the refining sector up to this point, which is, you know, the kind of unprecedented level of utilization reductions that we saw out of the group, cutting utilization rates from kind of 90%+ to sub-70% in a matter of just, you know, 2 or 3 weeks early on with this. And then a relative caution that they've shown so far and that we expect to continue in terms of their, in terms of ramping up utilization as demand rises. Right now we've seen gasoline demand in the U.S. go from about 50% down year on year to about 20% down year on year in recent weeks. You know, over that time period, we've seen refining utilization go from the, you know, high 60% range to the low 70% range. And so a relatively modest creep there. So, you know, we think that it's a little easier to manage. We think they'll continue to stay relatively proactive. And that even if you argue for a demand environment, let's say that it takes a few years to get back to that 100 million barrel a day level, and you've got utilization rates that implies for U.S. refiners that are probably 3 or 4% lower than they would have been, we think that's still relatively manageable. To generate margins that are still supportive compared to what's priced into the stocks and supportive for the underlying business model. I think beyond that, you know, again, we like companies. We like sectors that can maintain a decent amount of cash flow generating capacity through this. The refiners certainly fit that build. The majors, I think, generally, given their diversification and some, you know, leverage to downstream and chemicals, fit that. And then I think as we look across the E&P side, certainly low-cost producers is going to be. I mean, there was already a trend for years kind of going in this direction. But given the relatively modest call that we expect going forward on U.S. supply growth and the amount of resource that's going to be fighting to supply that modest growth, you know, we think increasingly it's really going to be focused on a small group of relatively, you know, low cost, high quality producers that can win in this relatively flat cost curve and supply that modest growth.
And the one thing I would add on top of that, Ryan, and this is a direct quote from the note, the macro note that we published last week that I referenced earlier, but we wrote, quote, "The continued imperative for operational efficiency and scale should necessitate an industry rationalization and consolidation thesis of considerable magnitude." So certainly a need for consolidation for the industry. And then as we move to wrap up today's conference call, I want to now position it where what could surprise energy investors over the next few years, and so we'll start with Ryan and then with me. But Ryan, what do you think could surprise energy investors over the next few years?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think there's a couple things when I think about it. I mean, one is I think there's a decent chance that U.S. supply ends up being far more resilient than we expected or feared going into this, right? And I think some of this shows up in the way that our forecasts for U.S. supply volumes have changed just over the last 3 months, right? Which is that, you know, we expected a far more severe trough at one point. And I think what you're seeing is I think U.S. companies have the ability to surprise with lower maintenance capex levels, higher quality production and better ability to kind of drive that resilient supply than that could really surprise people. Now that's kind of, it's a little bit of a two-edged sword. It's good for the companies in some ways, but it could serve as a little extra headwind for crude pricing recovery. I think we could be surprised by the pace at which we could see this demand transition accelerate. And, you know, there we could be surprised by some of these things that we expected to take place over, 10 or 15 or 20 plus years could play out much more quickly than we expected. And maybe it's just, again, from an anecdotal point of view, you saw today headlines Lyft out there saying that by the end of this decade, 100% of their fleet would be electric vehicles, and then kind of coming out and saying, hey, we're taking advantage. We think this pandemic is going to accelerate stuff, which, give us the opportunity to accelerate stuff, which is always going to happen. So is there a risk that we pull forward some of that transition? On the flip side, on a much more bullish surprise, I think that, you know, for all that we say, if demand's really hard to forecast right now, and if demand, which very easily could surprise to the upside versus our expectations, you know, if that happens, I think there's a real possibility that we have, that there's a spike in crude price, you know, 2 or 3 years down the line where you end up with a very real multi-year cycle coming out of this with much, much tighter balances that a lot of us expect, and a crude price which is able to sustain, you know, 60 plus on the in the other direction. So, you know, I think there could be some big surprises in either direction, but those are a few that I'm thinking about.
Yeah, Ryan, and what I would add on top of that, you know, my big surprise would pick up on your bullish comment, which is that you've got some countries that are very insecure that are key members of OPEC, and are going through quite a bit right now with these low prices impacting their treasuries and their ability to provide services to the citizenry. And, to name one in particular, Iraq, which in April provided the world about 4.5 million barrels a day of production. And so if you had a problem in that country, that's meaningful. Or Nigeria, which provided 1.8 million barrels a day. Place like Algeria, which provided 1 million barrels a day. So if the stress and strain that the U.S. onshore companies are feeling is also going to be felt by those countries, and maybe even more so because they're kind of break-even oil price to balance their budgets and to provide some of the services that they want for their citizens are at a much higher price than sort of their underlying well economics are. So, and that would be a bullish outcome and certainly something to watch. So we want to thank you for joining us and attending today's call. A replay will be made available. And please join us next week, which is Thursday, June the 25th at 12 p.m. Central Standard Time, as we will be hearing from Stephen Scooten, Scott Seifers, and Jeff Hart, who are senior research analysts on the financial services team, talking about navigating a COVID-altered banking space. So again, thanks so much. And if you do have any other questions about today's presentation, please reach out to your Piper Simmons representative. And with that, you may now disconnect. Thank you.